5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. Ignition. Liftoff.
Hello. Welcome back. This is Partially Derivative. It's been a while, but we're finally back. Today, we do not have Alec. We do not have Alec on the podcast. However, we do have a special guest, possibly reoccurring, Monica Guzik, who is actually a chemical engineer at NASA. And the topic for today is going to be space flight and space predictions for 2021. So, Monica, if you would like to give yourself a formal introduction.
Yeah, hey, everybody. Like you said, my name's Monica. I'm also Noah's cousin, which makes me even cooler. I do work at NASA. None of the things I say here are government opinion, but hopefully I can provide some interesting observations on some of these. I do actually work right now as the chief engineer on a upcoming ISS, International Space Station experiment. So I do have at least some familiarity with some of the space stuff we'll be talking about today.
All right, yeah. So I think we're just gonna get right into it. I have a couple articles pulled up here. One's from the Washington Post, and one is actually from space.com. So basically, to start off, I think we're just gonna talk about, you know, not only NASA, but, you know, third party space agencies that are making advancements in 2021, including SpaceX and actually Boeing. And the title of the Washington Post article actually names Jeff Bezos, which I did not know was into commercial space flight. But to start off, we will start with NASA. So let's start with Perseverance. So Perseverance is a, and correct me if I'm wrong, if anything I say is, you know, incorrect, but Perseverance is a Mars rover that was launched in, I believe, July of 2020, and it's set to arrive at Mars on February 18th. And it says it will land in a region called the Jezero crater. Yeah, what's the mission, or what do you know about that? Like, what's the point of it?
Yeah, we're excited about that one. Well, so one of the things that Mars 2020 is looking at is, first of all, we were really excited because, you know, we found water ice on Mars, which one of the things NASA is always looking at is, where's their life? And we're not looking at necessarily life right now, but we're looking at signs of it from the past. We're really interested in thinking of like more microbes than, we're not looking at finding turtles or anything like that, but bacteria, things like that, very, very small life forms. And we're really looking at it to try to figure out if we can understand how it formed somewhere else. Maybe we can kind of figure out more about how it formed here. So that's one thing that they're looking at is looking for more water sources. We've looking at water as one of the building blocks. Hydrogen, carbon are kind of the two building blocks of life, and water is a huge portion of that. So they're looking for a lot of rock samples, soil samples. There's actually going to be a Mars helicopter that is going to be hitching a ride as well to do some observations from the atmosphere. Mars does have some atmosphere to it, not breathable, of course, but enough to support that effort. So we're excited too, because Glenn Research Center, where I work, has actually participated in some of the science that's going on 2020. So we're looking for life, and then we're also got a few technologies on there that are sort of demonstrators for what we could maybe use to utilize, we call it in situ resources. So things that are already on a planet, trying to use them to support a manned mission. So that would be breaking down the soil, which has carbon, and using hydrogen from water or in the atmosphere to combine and make methane, which we can use as a fuel. That's one thing we look at. Or even to break down water and make oxygen. Those are types of technologies that we can do. We call it utilizing the in situ or already there resources. So there's a couple science demonstrations, kind of units on that rover that'll help us with that, as well as trying to understand a little bit better perhaps some of the early things on a planet that can support life, because Mars is actually looking like it potentially maybe had it at one point, or at least the indicators to support life at some point.
Yeah, that's really cool. So just a quick aside, actually, I have actually been listening to Joe Rogan, and he's had on a couple guests that talk about alien possible extraterrestrials visiting Earth, and he's very into the possibility that happened. I know you're talking about possibly life that has existed on Mars in the past, but what is your opinion on maybe not necessarily the scientific perspective, but just like, what do you think about, you know, the possibility of either life that has existed or life that has visited the Earth or things like that?
Yeah, so again, opinions are my own. I personally, if you look at the likelihood of some other life form developing to the sophistication that would support travel to a location as far as ours, that likelihood is extremely low. Just because, I mean, if you look even within our solar system, there's only one planet that really has been able to support an advanced life that we can confirm. And that we look at our future space travel and how far we can extend with our, even if you look at the way out there technologies like the hyperdrives that folks are developing and in some of the university laboratories, that won't be able to take us far enough to get to the planet's next planet that we think maybe could support at least an atmosphere that could support Earth life like ours planet does. So the level of sophistication advancement that another culture on another planet would have to support to get here is the statistically very, very. So to me, I, you know, there's no evidence for it that I've seen. I've seen a lot of arguments that there is. I've seen some of those videos too. So I'm not totally buying into it. But I do enjoy listening to the theories. So there's also no evidence against it. And I do like the enthusiasm that kind of thought brings to looking further into our solar system and beyond it to try to find life. So I like the support it brings for some of our NASA missions as well.
Yeah, like we don't have to go down the rabbit hole, but I know Joe Rogan has had on Bob Lazar, who was probably like, I don't know if you've heard of him. He was like an engineer in Area 51, and he says a whole bunch of stuff, but we won't go down that rabbit hole. So yeah, perseverance is very cool. Hopefully, you know, it'll bring back some good data, and you know, maybe wasn't it confirmed that there was ice on Mars already? Or I thought I heard something about that.
Yeah, so Curiosity found some. Which is actually kind of cool to say. I love the way we name our rovers. Curiosity did find some, which was really exciting. And we've actually confirmed that there's some on the moon as well. And where there's ice, there's water. And where there's water, like I said, we can use water to support so many different human presence. Not necessarily to drink, but we can break it down and make fuel. We can turn it into breathable air. So when we find water, not only is it something that we think could indicate that there was a system that one day supported life. Yeah, not only when you find water does that mean that maybe like one day life could have been there, or at least indicator, you know, we could look at some of the early formations of what made water stay on one planet versus another. But we also can support a human presence, and that's really something that we get excited about. So when Curiosity found water in the form of ice, that was pretty exciting. I think
that'd be pretty cool. So I guess the next topic can pivot to, you know, sort of the third party, you know, private space industry. And we'll start with your favorite, SpaceX. So apparently, you know, doesn't NASA want SpaceX to succeed? Like, there, this article says SpaceX is flying for Axiom Space, which is a Houston-based company. That's a private, you know, mission. That's like private citizens going to the moon. And, you know, yeah.
Yeah, we're actually, NASA as an agency is extremely supportive of commercial space industry. One thing, you know, you look at what the role, and this is mostly me talking, you can find some official statements, but you look at the role of what NASA does, and we really are pushing the envelope of trying to explore new horizons when you look at our manned space program. So some of the things that we've done already, like go to the space station, develop a living, human, breathing presence in low Earth orbit, that's something that we've worked always closely with industry on doing. You know, industry has always been a close partner of NASA, even on the NASA-led side. So having commercial industries come in and take over some of that presence and the launch services, and actually having NASA become a customer, that's something that we like. It lets us focus on the next thing that comes up, and two, it really gives back to the United States economy, which is one of the things the government is really supposed to be doing, I think. So we are really excited to see companies like SpaceX and Blue Origin and Boeing and Northrop Grumman, and I hope if I leave another company out, it's not because I don't like them. but we're really excited about these companies that are coming up with some really innovative systems. Whether it's commercial tourism, space tourism is actually with some of the focus of some of these companies is just purely space tourism. I mean, that's exciting just on a personal level. That maybe I don't know that I'll have the money in my lifetime, but my kids may actually, or my grandkids may one day be actually able to take a flight and take an orbit around Earth for a little bit more than maybe they would take to go to Disneyland. So that's kind of a cool thing to think about. Disneyland is still a very expensive vacation, but to think that's around the horizon is pretty sweet. And then companies looking at pushing the envelope of where we can go, not only to the space station, but like Elon really wants to go to Mars, or a lot of other companies are looking at developing their own lunar access systems. That's awesome, because all that does is push the envelope of the technology, and it pushes our country as a whole to stay on the leading edge of aerospace. And that's really what we're about. And you go beyond our country, we have a lot of global partners that are extremely invested in reaching particularly the moon, and are developing their own systems either in partnership with us or through their own faculty. And that pushes everybody, that pushes the technology ahead. And when you have that sort of global concentrated effort across government and across industry, that's when you really quickly, rapidly make advancements. In the last time, you know, you look at some of the industrial revolutions. I mean, maybe we're going to have a space revolution here, where all of a sudden we have a global access to space that we have never had before. And that's really cool to think about. And that could happen. You know, I may be old by the time it manifests, but that could happen in my lifetime.
So when you say, when you say you could be, you know, old by the time that happens, what do you, like, in our lifetime, what do you think, like, the, how should I say it? What do you think the extent of space travel, at least in the next, well, let's just start with the next year and then we can go on. In the next year, like, what do you think will be, do you think there will be any, like, pivotal moments in, you know, upcoming that launch, you know, some other program or something like that?
Well, you're going to see commercial companies regularly supplying both people and products to the space station, for sure. You're going to see, I think, at least two, maybe three companies doing that now, which is massive, because now we've got multiple United States-based rockets and companies providing services to the International Space Station, rather than only one other country, which in the past has been Russia. So we always had, we could supply goods up there, but now we're supplying people and from our soil. And that is amazing. And I think next year you're going to see not just one company, but multiple companies being able to send up astronauts to the space station. That saves us a lot of money on the NASA side, and it also really helps those companies get a presence in space. So that for sure is one thing you're going to see next year that will be really, really exciting and something to really watch for, on whatever, however you like to watch on NASA TV or on YouTube or on the company streaming sites themselves. Those will be fun launches to watch.
Yeah, I actually might. I don't usually watch, space launches, but I think I've never seen one in person either. So I might, start watching like this year, especially. Actually, I did watch the Crew Dragon launch because that was pretty big. But the other plans for SpaceX in 2021 are Crew 2 is going to have it. It's going to have its second fully operational mission, and it's going to launch 4 astronauts from the Kennedy Space Center. And then they're going to launch Crew 3. Washington Post is saying SpaceX will become the space shuttle successor. So like you said, private industry, investing money into, space flight is pretty good. And then, also the Starship spacecraft, which I have also never seen that. Do you know anything about the Starship? Because that looks like it's going to be their kind of, magnum opus in terms of spacecraft.
Yeah, so Starship is their magnum opus is a good word for it. I know they've been doing some prototype launches. That's their big heavy lift launcher. And the super heavy, I should say, they used to call it that. So they've been making some very good strides in Starship, and I know they want to get some payloads up there as early as next year. And it'll be really nice to see a heavy lift rocket launch again. As you may know, SLS is the NASA heavy lift vehicle that's under development, and they've had a couple test flights already. So one of the things when they refer to a shuttle successor, what's really interesting is the current capabilities that we have with crewed missions is much, much smaller. They're more on the scale of the capsule type design that we had back when we had the Saturn rockets, when we had the Gemini rockets. So the lift capability on those rockets, when I mean essentially how much mass they can get up into orbit, is much smaller. And the volume that they can pack is pretty small. So the big difference between what we've got with the current Crew Dragon and what we had with Shuttle is how much other stuff we can take up with the astronauts. So Shuttle was we'll never probably have another rocket like Shuttle. Shuttle was extremely expensive, but we could do things like fully assemble the International Space Station. We could do things like launch and repair Hubble. With Shuttle, and Shuttle was almost like a tractor trailer type that could take with a huge amount of people in it that could live really comfortably. So we've gotten away from that type of vehicle for good reasons. There's very good reasons why. So these new crewed rockets are very valuable, but they don't necessarily have that heavy lift capability. They can't take up people and something as large as, say, the Hubble telescope or something as large as space station. Module part. So these heavy lift vehicles that NASA's developing, that SpaceX is developing, I think there's one or two others, those are going to be super important because those are going to get back to launching payloads that are very heavy and very large that we can use to build space habitats, that we can use to send up very large rovers and things like that can be used on the surface of the moon. They can be used to launch some of the concepts for going to Mars, actually have in-space assembly of stages in order to get multiple large fuel tanks that can carry us back and forth to Mars. So these heavy lift rockets are really exciting and important because we need them in order to get back to the kinds of capabilities we had in terms of lifting stuff into orbit shuttle. So you really need both the crewed mission and you need these heavy lift rockets if we want to go to the moon or. So I'm very excited to see these developments.
So in terms of getting to Mars, the biggest limitation would be the amount of fuel that's required to get there. Is that correct?
That is so fuel and also duration, right? So there's actually probably three things that are hard for Mars. One is how long it takes to get there, no matter what, because it's I think it's about a year and a half trip at the minimum. You can look that up. Whoever's watching this probably just looked it up and corrected me. But so that is a really long time to keep somebody alive, just one person alive. You got to take up all the food. You got to take up all the water unless you recycle it, which one of the things that station is really nice is how do you sustain life for that long? You got to keep them healthy. So if somebody gets sick or somebody breaks an arm or, you know, gets a deep cut, there's no doctors, you can't send to the hospital. So you got to have everything there to take care of them. You've got to keep them healthy. So there's got to be exercise equipment. You've got to keep them sane. So there's got to be stuff for them to do. You know, they're alone with the same crew for that long period of time. They may not have regular contact to home. So that's the human factor of going to Mars is something that we don't think about, but is actually probably one of the biggest challenges. Next to that is one area that actually I have a lot experience in, like you said, fuel. Most of the baseline missions for Mars and cryogenic fuel, which means it's something that's normally found as a gas at standard atmosphere and pressure here on Earth. So we store it as a liquid because that's way more efficient and we can pack a lot more molecules. But then we have to do that, you have to make it very cold. So cryogenic just means really, really cold. It's usually around, I think, scientists kind of argue where the point of what cryogenics is. It's usually 150 Kelvin to 220. So we're at, when we start talking about cold, I think liquid hydrogen is around like negative 420 degrees Fahrenheit. So that's it's 20 Kelvin. It's a lot easier to talk about cold. So when you have something that needs to be stored that cold for that long, it becomes difficult because while space itself has no air, so there's no surrounding atmosphere to warm you up, there are a lot of radiative heat sources like the sun, and you don't have a buffer of an atmosphere from the sun or even other planets radiating onto you or other parts of the spacecraft that need to be warm conducting or radiating heat to your fuel. So you have to be able to keep your fuel for long, and that's where there's a big challenge in how do you make sure your fuel doesn't deplete by the time you get to where you need to go. And that's one thing that making fuel on the planetary surface becomes really important. So cryogenic storage is a huge area that we're looking at that I actually, until I took this, my current job, was very heavily involved in. And then the third issue kind of goes back to the human factor, and it's radiation. You get outside. Earth is actually in a really special place that's protected from some of the highly radiative environments. So when you get outside of that protective zone and you start going to Mars, now you've got a heavily radiated environment that can make could potentially really make your astronauts sick. It can even make but we've figured out how to protect our instruments. Protecting our astronauts, it's a lot more difficult. They've even talked about making maybe like living under soil if they're on the surface and making underground getaways radiation.
So in terms of fuel, like you said, you worked extensively in that area. What would you say is the most promising fuel? Let's start off with what is the current fuel that's most commonly used with rockets, you know, whether it be the manned missions or the heavy rockets? And then what do you think the most promising fuel is that will be developed or is being developed, over the course of however long it takes to get to Mars. Like, what do you think the most promising fuel is that would be used to get to Mars?
Okay, so we'll start with right now, hydrogen and oxygen. So you always have your oxidizer. So in hydrogen is a pretty common fuel that folks look at, and one we understand pretty well, one that shuttle uses. So combination of hydrogen and oxygen. We also use, though, really heavily, we call it hypergolic propellants. Hydrazine is one of those hypergols. What they are highly reactive chemical compounds that are actually they're not really good for people, but they are very reactive, and they're easier to control, and we call them storable because they store at closer to ambient temperature and pressure. So they're a lot easier to store, but they're a lot harder to deal with because they're highly toxic. That is a really common use. Almost every rocket has some sort of hypergolic system, whether for main propellant or for we call it reaction control, but that just means steering in space. You fire a little thruster. So hypergols are really common right now. Hydrogen and oxygen are pretty common for short duration. Folks also use either kerosene or methane instead of hydrogen because it's much easier to store, much higher temperature than hydrogen, probably. So those are really the big ones in play, are these hypergols, hydrogen, and divisive topic on which one is the most attractive. And it really kind of, I've found, it depends on what technologies you work with as to which one's your favorite. Really, it's also mission dependent. So if you wanted hypergols, like I said, difficult to store, but there's so much, we've used them for so long, we know exactly how they work, and temperature control isn't as much of an issue. So if you're trying to do something easy and cheap and quick, you may go with a hypergolic propellant. But if you're trying to do long duration storage, they don't give you, isn't necessarily the bang for your buck, so to say, for thrust or what we call specific impulse or ISP. So, which is just a fancy, a different way of measuring kind of thrust. And so we start to look at, for Mars, methane and hydrogen. Those are really competitive. Methane is easier to store. It has a much lower kind of oomph factor to it compared to hydrogen. But it is also something that we have technologies that are closer to being complete that we can actually use, like the soil on Mars, to create more methane. So that gets really exciting, especially when you start talking about like ascent and descent vehicles on Mars or even the moon. Because it's easy to store, you can probably create it on the surface, so you'd only have to take it one direction and create the rest on your return. So that's a pretty popular fuel source right now. Hydrogen, much harder to store, but hydrogen is for many applications, kind of the best bang for your buck, if you can figure out how to store it. It's also a lot harder to create on the surface than methane in a lot of ways. So those are kind of the two big ones. Hydrogen seems to be pretty popular for in-space transport, where methane seems to be pretty popular to get on the surface, so to do a descent, and then to get off the surface or ascent. So I wouldn't be surprised if we continue to use hypergols perhaps in the smaller reaction control systems that don't need as much thrust. So I wouldn't be surprised if you see all three. We're also doing green propellants to try to replace the hypergols with a less toxic version. Can't drink it, but it's not gonna kill you either if you get near it. So those are probably the big ones. I have worked a lot on low temperature, high capacity storage of hydrogen. So that tends to be my favorite, just because a lot of the technologies that I've worked on a lot are really shine when it comes to hydrogen. But methane is going to be a pretty big player in future missions.
Yeah, that's actually very interesting. I didn't even think of the possibility of making fuel on the surface once you get there. That's pretty cool. So moving on from SpaceX, I don't know how much you know about Boeing's work, but Boeing's, I believe Boeing's biggest, their biggest spacecraft is Starliner. And they, Boeing seems to have had a lot more trouble than, you know, SpaceX. I don't think they're putting as much money into it, but they're having a upcoming test flight with, I believe, Starliner. I think it was their, it says their software on Starliner had trouble in at the end of 2019. And then obviously the, with airliners with the 737 MAX airplane. So what can you tell us about, you know, Boeing's work in the space industry?
So, I don't really have a favorite company because I think they all bring something really unique to the game. SpaceX has had its challenges as well. We've seen the videos actually that they're pretty open about sharing when they have a mishap or an incident. They've had a couple, rockets on the pads go. So every company has its challenges and its setbacks, and they always learn something from it. So Starliner, when they had their test flight, actually had a lot of big successes. I mean, they had a great launch. They had a good landing. They did have the software issue that caused them to have trouble with their docking. But honestly, we always say you learn a lot more from failure than success. I know NASA loves to say failure is not an option, which is why we do test flights, because we don't want to fail when there's people on board. So we've learned a lot. These companies have learned a lot every time that they have a failure, or so to speak. I mean, like I said, they had so many successes on that flight. They checked a lot of boxes that were functional. They got very close to much closer to qualifying their vehicle for flight. And they learned what went wrong and are able to work to fix it. So you kind of look at it, if you look at it that way, it's almost a success. They're a little bit, I think SpaceX got started on their rocket a little earlier. They have very different in companies, hierarchies, very different setups. Boeing, though, has been in the space game for an extremely long time. They're one of the one of the early companies. I mean, the Lockheed Martins and the Northrop Grumman's and folks like that are the kind of the old guard of spaceflight. Boeing's got their own rockets that launch satellites. So they are old hat. They've worked for a long time in the space industry. So they'll get there as well. I think the new next test flight is going to go really well as well as the upcoming SpaceX operational flights.
Yeah. Actually, here's another topic that I forgot about, but I just looked up. Do you know anything about the Tom Cruise movie that will be officially shot from space? He will be the first actor to shoot a movie from space. It says it's in 2021. Do you know anything about that?
You know, I don't, but that sounds really cool. Do you know what rocket they're going to go on? Or what vehicle?
I don't believe it says what their plans are, but it says end of 2021, like October, he will be going to, he'll be working with SpaceX and NASA, and he will be going SpaceX Crew Dragon Axiom Taurus flight.
Oh, that's pretty cool. Yeah, so that is when I said, you know, we're going to see space tourism. You're going to start seeing, I think, more movies like this. There's a couple, Virgin Galactic has actually got a rocket that they're building pretty soon. Sierra Nevada has another rocket. Those are going to be more space tourism rockets themed. So you're going to start seeing, I think, more movies that are filmed in orbit. And I think you're going to start seeing more celebrities going into space. That's going to be the first step. It's not going to be accessible to you and I yet, because it's just going to be expensive because they have to fund that launch and everything. But I do think we're going to get to the point eventually where people are going to be saving up for several years, and instead of going and taking, going to Disney World or going to that travel vacation in Europe that's very expensive, they're going to be saving up to take a space flight. There, you know, you're going into low Earth orbit. You're not necessarily going up to the moon. You're not going to go that far yet. But I think you're going to start seeing more of that. So this is like the first step. I'm pretty excited to hear it. You know, NASA's actually has a history of being a film location for movies. The Avengers was filmed at the Plumberg Station in Sandusky. It was kind of cool. They still have a sign hanging there advertising the filming. There's a lot of movies filmed at Cape Canaveral, including Transformers. So we've always kind of been heavily involved in the arts industry as well as the commercial space technology industry. So I'm excited to hear that's happening. I don't know anything about it, but I do think we're going to hear more and more things like that as we get further into 2021 and 2022.
Yeah, that would definitely be hopefully be a cool movie, because Tom Cruise is a good actor. He does all his own stunts. That's why he's going to be the first one. But yeah, that was just a quick aside. So another mission or space program that I believe is NASA. The Washington Post says that the Trump administration has asked to or directed NASA to speed up the timeline for a lunar landing to 2024 from 2028. And they have approved an $850 million budget for the spacecraft that would land astronauts on the lunar surface. So, and it says NASA says it needed $3.3 billion. So in terms of going back to the moon, what are your thoughts and what are the timeline for doing that? And what is the point, I guess, in going back to the moon?
Oh man. Okay. So this is something that I feel I'm really, honestly, extremely excited about. Ministry of Bridenstine has been a really good, I think, supporter of us. Congress, we have bipartisan support in Congress for this directive. So that's what's really exciting about it, is it's everybody, both sides of the fence are kind of all on board for going back to the moon in Congress. And write your congressman and tell him to give us that full budget. No, I'm just kidding. Not really kidding. But we're very excited at NASA because one thing we know, we've been to the moon. And we have been to the moon, all you skeptics out there. We've been to the moon. We've done some science there. We broke some boundaries. We learned a lot, but we did it a long time ago. You know, a lot of those engineers have moved on. Many, unfortunately, we've lost a lot of those folks that have walked the surface. But also, we've never lived there. So we're learning on the space station how to live in space. If you think about it, the only place on Earth that you can really compare to living somewhere where you can't get help right away is either deep underwater, which is really difficult to do, or say like Antarctica, where you've got folks that are stuck there for months at a time when the weather gets bad and the winters are bad and they can't get out. There's wholly self-reliant. So we don't have a lot of analogs to that type of isolated living. And then you add on top of it all of the physical challenges you have with reduced gravity or microgravity, communication blackouts, things like that. So the space station has been critical for us to figure out how to do that. But the moon, a planetary surface, living there, figuring out how to be there for long periods of time where you know, the space station, you can get in an emergency capsule and you can go back to Earth. They do have that bailout plan. There's always an emergency capsule there that if they need to, they can come back to Earth. Hopefully we never have to. But on the moon, that bailout plan becomes much more difficult. You can't just get in a capsule and go back to Earth. To get in a vehicle that launches you off of the planetary pull of the lunar surface, and then you have to get to the vehicle that takes you back to Earth, because it's two different vehicles, and you have multiple burns that take you to different trajectories. So it's a much more complicated plan. Then you have to figure out, how do you sustain life there? What kind of technologies do you do? A lot of those technologies are similar technologies to what you would need on Mars. So you can get way more science done when you're there for an extended period of time. So it's kind of a proving ground for us. When I say us, I mean really the global space industry. It's really a proving ground for us in coordination with industry and with other space agencies, India, Europe, Japan, all of these, Russia, they're all interested in working with NASA to do this. So it's really a global effort. So you're kind of trying to bridge some gaps that maybe the countries don't necessarily get along in any other area, but they're collaborating in space. And they're figuring out how to live there. We're developing a lot of new technologies. If you think about actually like one of the coolest technologies I heard about is they do portable ultrasounds now. That have really advanced some of the field science, field medicine that we can do, or even like in an emergency room, a handheld ultrasound. That was developed in partnership with a NASA grant because NASA needed the ability to do ultrasounds on astronauts that were doing extended living in space. So all of this is kind of both filtering back to improving life on Earth, but also just more steps in expanding where we can travel, how we can keep astronauts alive, learning more about our solar. So why go to the moon is kind of, everybody's got a different answer. But for me, it's to learn how to go have an extended long-term presence on another surface, further far away from Earth, how to live there, how to keep people alive there, what technology development you need to be there. And then from there, we can go and go further and further. Kind of like the colonial, in the early days of when exploration, it wasn't in space, it was Europeans going and exploring the new world. There were some problems with that as well. But when you look at how they did it, they had to kind of hop from different places, and every time they went a little further, you look at it that way, we're almost doing this. We're just trying to be a little bit better stewards of the locations we go to than they were.
Yeah. So is that like the ultimate goal? Are there plans to have like a moon base with a staging ground to get to another planet like Mars? Is that something that's feasible?
So there's a lot of different we call them architectures, which is what we call the plans we have and how to do Mars travel. So some have looked at using the moon either as the surface itself or more likely a meeting point in orbit near the moon. So right now, actually, we're developing the Lunar Gateway, and that is a space station that is closer to the moon that we can use to go to the surface and then back up to the space station. Because the first step is going to be spend maybe days on the moon or a day and then go to several days and then kind of build up the duration that we can stay there. We're not going to be living there. So that's something a lot of folks are interested in. A lot of commercial companies in other countries are interested in an extended duration on the moon. So that is one of the things primarily I think is probably going to be for science, potentially for trying to use some take advantage of some resources. I think it's mostly going to be almost like a science base like we have on space station, and then using that meet point also as a place to muster resources at the space station and then go to Mars. That way you don't have to land launch. You can just kind of meet at a space station. Other architectures have us doing all of that in low Earth orbit and going straight to Mars. So there are a bunch of different ideas on what makes the most sense and how to get to Mars. So whether or not the moon or the lunar orbit is the spot we stop on our way is kind of yet to be seen. But it is considered. And at the very least, it's a way to figure out how do you muster in one spot? Because no matter what, we're going to have to launch what we take to Mars on a few rockets and assemble it in space. So it's kind of how do we do that at a location that's maybe not low Earth orbit and then to and from a planet from that location. That we will learn by going to the moon.
Yeah, that would be very interesting. You know, I can see the different, you know, as you say, the different archetypes. You know, you could use the moon, you could use space station, or in terms of, does that timeline sound right? Do you think you could be back on the moon by 2024? Because this is what the Washington Post is saying.
Yeah, so that's everybody's favorite question to ask an NASA employee. So we do need, I think we do need the money that Bridenstine has kind of put forward. With a reduced budget, it's going to be much more difficult because there are some challenges there. But we do have, we call it the HLS, the Human Landing System. I think there's still some contracts out there. But there are a couple contracts have been awarded with companies to develop systems that we need in collaboration with NASA to get there. Like I said, we're trying to work closely with industry on this to be our partners. So two companies have already gotten contracts on to do it, and those contracts do have commit dates on them to come in 2024. So we're working very hard to that date. And I think it's possible. The budget is going to make it very challenging. And if we don't get a budget increase, I am not sure of what's going to happen.
NASA tends to be really creative
sometimes. So we may get there no matter what, but that remains to be seen. But I think that we are doing all the right things. And I actually have a lot of, I'm very hopeful too for the what comes with this new administration, that will continue to happen, considering how great and how bipartisan our support has been. I'm very optimistic.
Yeah, I would definitely support the full budget that NASA needs, because I know that's the rockets aren't cheap. Another topic actually that you mentioned earlier was international, coalitions and international efforts working together, different countries. The interesting thing I think about that is like the fact that Russia, just potentially had a massive cyber attack against the U.S. government, and yet we are working with them, to go to the moon. I think that's really cool. Both Russia and China, I believe, we work internationally with them. What is the other couple other countries that have the biggest programs that NASA works with?
Well, I'd say European Space Agency is one of our biggest partners. Actually, Canadian Space Agency as well. They built and run the robot arm on space station right now. But ESA, we call it ESA, European Space Agency, is a huge partner of ours. And they're kind of a conglomeration of several European agencies that work together with us. JAXA, which is the Japanese Space Agency as well, we have a very close partnership with. And then there's a lot of other countries. India actually is a growing partner, the Indian Space Agency, with us. So there's new, it seems like each day almost, or each month, I see a new press release of a new country that's kind of got a burgeoning space program that NASA's that wants to work with NASA. And it's not just on these big rockets. A lot of it is sharing science data. We're finding some of these countries have run experiments that we have not yet run, and rather than pay for them ourselves, we're doing an exchange of experimental data. So maybe somebody in another country, say Germany, has run an experiment that we'd like to see, and we've run an experiment that they want to see, and we do a data exchange. So there's a lot of more collaboration than just building a rocket. It's really kind of on every level of development, which is pretty awesome. And I always kind of look at it as, you look at the Olympics, and the Olympics has always been really special to me, just because you see all of these countries that don't get along in the media, or don't get along at the State Department level, but they can all kind of put that aside and compete in a global arena like the Olympics. And it's a you know, a fair, just competition that everybody kind of tunes in to see, or like the World Cup is another example. So athletics has always been a meeting ground of countries to come in a neutral soil. And I think space has the ability to be another place where it's a neutral meeting ground, where folks are really just looking at technology development and advancing humanity. And I think it has, I'm getting a little bit hopeful and optimistic here. I'm kind of like that, but space has the ability to bring people together. And I think we have to come together in that way in order to do what we need to do. I think it has to be a global effort. It has to be a diverse effort. People of different backgrounds, not just within other countries, but within our country. You know, we need a very diverse group of people to get us to the moon, because we need those ideas that are going to come from places that maybe they've not historically come from. So I think space is so unique in that it's so difficult and it's got so many more challenges to it that it has the ability to bring people together where they can't or won't work together in other areas. And I really, that's one of the reasons that I love working in this industry, is because.
Yeah, I think any you know, program or topic that can, you know, sort of transcend, you know, the everyday, you know, politics with other nations is definitely something that should be, you know, put a, you know, focused on, and a lot of resources and attention should be put into it, because that's the ultimate goal. We would just want, you know, all of humanity to work together and not worry about, you know, who's stealing the oil from another country or whatever. I guess, you know, we're going to wrap it up here, I think, but just give me, you know, your predictions in the next 10 years, say. So by 2030, where do you think we will be in terms of, you know, Mars, or, you know, things, you know, other advancements in space travel, just say in the next 10 years, what are your predictions?
All right. Well, let's be ambitious here. So I really think no matter what, and we're definitely going to have a space station that is closer to the moon, either in orbit around it or in orbit near it. We are going to have a presence on the moon, whether it's probably, I'd say maybe just being able to be there for maybe a month, 2 months at a time, and live and work there before we come home. I don't know that it's going to be permanent. But I think you're going to see a presence on the moon that is sustained. We're going to be going there maybe once a year, working there for a while and coming back. I think the space station is going to see that same action. I think the International Space Station is probably going to be continued to operate, but people are going to start talking about decommissioning it or replacing it, or perhaps increasing the amount of time that we are at the lunar station, because it's going to be getting old at that point. I think you're going to probably seize, wouldn't be surprised at the end of the 2020s, maybe like December 2029, you may see a heavy lift rocket go and orbit Mars and come back. I don't think it probably won't be manned. I don't think, who knows, it could be, but I think you're actually going to see that happen. And I think you're going to see some really exciting rovers. I think you're going to see a lot of rovers on the moon doing science. And I think you're going to see some more on big ones go to Mars. And we probably are going to get a mission to launched at least to a planet like me, or a moon maybe like Europa, where we're looking at maybe we could have life right now. There's some of these methane oceans on these planets, these moons, that we think could actually be supportive of life. As we, you know, microbial again, probably not massive life forms, but I think you're going to see a mission at least launched that will have one of those destinations in mind. And we're also going to see the James Webb Space Telescope finally operational. That's going to replace Hubble. And we're going to be able to look deeper into our universe than we've ever seen before. So I think that is going to find, I think we're going to find a lot of really cool stuff from the James Webb by the end of 2020, a decade, by 2030. So that's another side on the planetary side. Pretty cool.
All right. Well, one last question is real quick. December of 2029, has there been a man on Mars or no?
So I don't think so. There may be one that's orbited it. But I'm going to say no, but I'm hopeful I'm wrong, but I think we're going to be close. I think we maybe sent a person around it, but I'm going to say we haven't actually landed yet.
All right. All right. That's going to conclude, this episode of Partially Derivative. Thank you, Monica, for being on. It was very, very insightful. I know I definitely learned a bunch. Hopefully anybody listening also learned, a lot too. Hopefully, you know, depending on what happens in the next couple weeks, we may have you as a recurring guest, or we might have the return of Alec. Might have Monica as a recurring guest. We will definitely have her on at some point in the future, though. So thank you again.